When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Vanta's market-leading trust management platform can help you unify security program management with a built-in risk register and reporting, and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 fast-growing companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. You can watch Vanta's on-demand video at vanta.com/decoder to learn more. That's vanta.com/decoder.
Support for this show comes from Wix Studio. Designers and devs, you might be able to do your thing better on Wix Studio, a web platform with everything you need to deliver bespoke sites hyper-efficiently. Design teams get a ton of smart features that can take the grind out of web creation without it costing per pixel control. Dev teams, you get a zero setup, developer-first environment, combined with an AI code assistant and your preferred IDE for rapid deployment. Search Wix Studio today to explore the full range of features.
Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Nilay Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and Decoder is my show about big ideas and other problems. Today I'm talking to Jonah Ehrlich. He's one of the core members of a group called Constitution DAO that tried to raise money to buy one of the original copies of the United States Constitution at an auction held by the high-end auction house Sotheby's. Now, raising money on the internet to do all kinds of things is a pretty familiar idea. There are crowdfunding campaigns for everything from new products to movies to scientific research to politics. But most of the crowdfunding we're used to happens through a central service, Kickstarter, GoFundMe, or Indiegogo, whatever. But the DAO in Constitution DAO is spelled D-A-O, which stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organization. Jonah and around 30 other people formed the DAO, then offered people around the world the ability to donate to it using the Ethereum blockchain. In exchange, those people would get the right to vote on what to do with this copy of the Constitution and what the organization should do in the future. So, no central service required, just the Ethereum cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. And their attempt to raise money this way was extremely successful. Constitution DAO raised something like $47 million. They verified enough money with Sotheby's to participate in the auction, and eventually they bid $43 million for this copy of the Constitution. Now, that wasn't quite enough to win. A hedge fund billionaire actually won. But it feels like a step. I'm just not entirely sure what that step means. So I asked Jonah to come on and explain how Constitution DAO got started, what happened with the auction, what the actual plan to handle one of the 13 remaining copies of the Constitution was if they'd won, and what happens to all the money now. There's a lot to the story that hasn't really been told yet, and I think it's a really useful look at the tension between the promise of crypto technologies like smart contracts and DAOs and the reality of getting a bunch of people together to do anything. We talk about decisions and management on Decoder a lot. So as you listen to this conversation, think about where adding the worldwide decentralized computing system actually added value to this project. Why did they need this technology to achieve their goal? I think that's the big question for a lot of crypto right now, and I really appreciated Jonah coming on the show to talk it over with me. Okay, Jonah Ehrlich from Constitution DAO. Here we go. Jonah Ehrlich, you are a software engineer and you are one of the core contributors to the Constitution DAO. Welcome to Decoder.
Thanks, Nilay. Glad to be here.
So you wanted to buy the Constitution. This is what I understand of your project.
Yeah. What started as a joke on Twitter led to being a very real bid in an auction to buy a copy of the U.S. Constitution. So it was a really great experience to kind of see and flex the power of the internet in just a week of trying to make this happen.
There's a lot to talk about with this, what happened with the bid, how the auction process actually went, what you're doing with the money you've raised so far. You've raised something like $47 million, although that's in Ethereum, so that number is kind of moving all the time. But I want to start with the very basics. Constitution DAO, that's Decentralized Autonomous Organization, DAO. What is a DAO?
That's a really great question. The definition of a DAO is just a group of people that come together around a shared community and a shared resource. The most fun description I've heard is it's a group chat with a bank account. What a DAO lets you do is have this very lightweight organizational structure to be able to move around assets and interact with the world.
Okay. We spend a lot of time on the show talking about organizational structures. Very few of them are lightweight in the end. You have a group chat with a bank account. How do you decide how to spend the money in the bank account?
So it depends on the DAO. DAOs are really in their infancy today, very early in the structures that they have. What most of them do is it's a voting process. So essentially, everyone that holds the token for a DAO will be able to vote. And they'll say, hey, there's this proposal. Let's say we want to buy the Constitution. As an example, all the token holders get a vote. There are more complicated and interesting mechanisms being worked on in the DAO world right now. And, you know, one of the jokes in the crypto world, it started with DeFi, where DeFi is speedrunning the history of finance. DAOs are kind of speedrunning the history of organizational structures. And right now, because they're so early, most of them operate on this very simple structure of direct democracy.
So if I contributed to Constitution DAO, what was I actually buying?
A donation to Constitution DAO is essentially, if we were to have succeeded at our bid, it would have been governance rights over the document of the U.S. Constitution. So there are 13 remaining copies of this document. We were trying to bid and win this document, and there would have been votes on what do we do with it. So some examples are, we had museums that were lined up that were going to give proposals on, hey, we should be the one to store and display this document. You would also be able to vote on what text should be displayed alongside of it. How should it be displayed? What message do we want to share with the world? Lastly, the thing that we would essentially have the ability to do is decide, what do we do now? Say we won the Constitution, we displayed it in a museum, there probably would be funds left over or a community that's really excited about doing things. And so setting the future direction was up to the token holders had we won that document.
So you were buying a token. I think I read on the website when you contributed, what you were fundamentally buying was a governance token. I believe it was called People, which was very funny. I appreciated that you're buying People, which has a dark side and a light side. It was a very funny name.
Yeah, it was a dark side. You know, this was something we moved very, very quickly on. And we were actually planning on rebranding the token had we won to something a little more positive.
What were you going to rebrand it to?
It was going to be WTP, We the People, or at least that was the leading idea. We really wanted it to be a positive thing. And we really listened to the community where people said they were uncomfortable with the name of the People token. That was something that was chosen very quickly. And we wanted to adapt to what the community wanted.
So when you buy tokens named People or WTP, was it one vote per token?
We had not figured out the governance model. In the rush to be able to buy this document, there are a lot of details that we were going to figure out after we had won. So we were actually discussing different governance models had we won. One of the big concerns is some of the large holders in the crypto world, we call these whales, would have outsized control over what happens with the documents. Our big message is this is a movement for the people. This is the people's document. We want to have it controlled by the people. So we were looking at different mechanisms. We were looking at the direct democracy voting, one token, one vote. We were also looking at what if it was just one wallet, one vote, which isn't an exact proxy for one person, but it's pretty close. There's also other mechanisms such as quadratic voting, where essentially as you have more tokens, your voting power is actually diminished. So you don't have, for every 100 extra tokens, 100 extra votes, but rather a smaller amount of votes as that number increases.
So when you say you're speedrunning the history of organizational structure, that is speedrunning the history of democracy, what you are describing, right? Setting up a voting system, figuring out how those votes will be representative of a group of people who are committed. But some set of people have to make those decisions. Those decisions are not democratic. How is that working for Constitution DAO?
So there's a good concept called progressive decentralization, where it's really hard to actually start something fully decentralized. So you have to start with an initial team that builds something and then brings it to decentralization. Our plan with Constitution DAO is we're going to win this auction. And then once we win, we're going as fast as possible to becoming fully decentralized to the greatest extent possible.
A lot of what I hear about with blockchain projects is trust and verification. What is the mechanism of accountability for that process? Right, I buy into this. You've made that promise. You're going to decentralize it as fast as possible. What makes you do that?
Everyone that was involved with this project was very public. You know, we had the signers on our multisig that were very public. We worked with an excellent nonprofit called Endowment, who helps with on-chain giving, to actually custody the documents and do our bid on behalf of Sotheby's. So it was a lot of personal reputations on the line for getting us to this point of decentralization. People that are trusted within the crypto community, within broader tech circles. So that's really what we were leaning on for the beginning of this process. And that's what happens with a lot of new technologies, is unfortunately you can't do it perfectly the first time. We're still very, very early with the capabilities of DAOs and the capabilities of crypto. So we wanted to be able to move as fast as possible and get things done and have that promise that we are going to get there. And I felt very confident that had we won the document, we'd be getting there very quickly.
Yeah, the reason I'm pushing on it is just a lot of what I hear from the crypto community is that you don't have to trust people, right? The software mm-hmm. will do it for you in some way, or we can build another mechanism of accountability that is automated or transparent or verifiable without some central control. And at the bottom of it, quite often, and I think in this case, it's you have to trust a bunch of people. At the end of the day, you have to look at some people and say, I trust them to do what they're going to say. And I'm wondering, did you perceive that tension as you were racing through this project?
Yeah, you are 100% right. There was trust you had to put into the Constitution DAO core team. One place we actually pivoted is initially we had what's called a multi-sig. So it's basically a smart contract that would hold the funds that was controlled by 13 different signers. 7 of them had to sign to move the funds. Initially, for the safety of those signers, we had them anonymous because it was a lot of money and we were concerned about their personal safety. But we heard from the community, hey, we're not okay with this. Many people didn't want to contribute because of that. So we asked the signers to volunteer and say, if you're comfortable sharing with you who you are, let us know and we're going to put you up on the website. And everyone decided to volunteer. So it was definitely an iterative learning process. The trust aspect is something that we definitely want to minimize in the long run. And I think what's really interesting here is how do you connect the physical world to the crypto world with these trust assumptions? One thing that I thought was really interesting, and I'm a little sad we didn't get to actually go into this area, but it's how do you make sure the physical document is actually governed according to the will of the token holders? So one of the ideas that we explored was moving it into a 501c3, where the bylaws of the 501c3 had the directors required to act in accordance to the will of the token holders.
And that will of the token holders expressed through a voting scheme that you hadn't determined yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's great tooling out there, but we hadn't officially determined anything yet.
I guess my question, and then I really want to get into the actual auction and the buying of the thing or the attempt to buy the thing. But my last threshold question here is, if you have to trust a bunch of people, some of whom I believe you knew personally,
mm-hmm.
and in the end it's voting, and voting just implies a level of politics. Every organization has politics. Why do you need a decentralized worldwide computer network to manage that? Because really you're just buying shares of a thing that provide you some governance rights. Mm-hmm. That is every corporation in America.
The way that I like to think about this is in terms of the types of agreements that exist in the world. And there's two primary agreements that we're used to. One is the agreements between people and society, right? These are laws along the lines of don't steal, don't avoid taxes, you know, a lot of things that are societal rules as a whole. The other part of that is agreements between individuals and agreements between entities. And what I think this does actually is it creates a much lighter weight framework for arbitration, for agreements between individuals. And so we can put as much as possible into the code as opposed into legal documents. And when it's in code, it's a lot easier to actually simulate what happens. It's a lot more difficult to interpret that in a way that was not intended. And you can put in those spots where you want human interpretability, but it creates a much more lightweight, efficient system for agreements between people. And that's why it's really important that it's on this decentralized structure, because it allows us to move a lot faster and more efficiently in that sense.
Put this into practice for me, though.
Mm-hmm.
I went to law school. I spent years of my life learning contract law. I'm not sure I learned anything that I retain to this day, but that is a well-established body of law.
Mm-hmm.
There's hundreds of years of doctrine behind contract law, which is just agreements between people. What exactly can you put in a code that automates contract law?
I mean, there's lots of things that are already running today. Once we had gotten the documents and the token holders had voting power, I think was a part of that. I think with a lot of this...
But why do you need a decentralized network of computers to manage something like, here's some proposed text for a museum display of the Constitution. Is this what you want? Why can't you do that on a centralized computer?
I think the point of why you can't do it on a centralized computer, or why it's more difficult on a centralized computer, is because you don't have the same guarantees that you do on a blockchain. So, for example, you can directly audit the code and read the code of what the agreement is that you're interacting with, where that's much more difficult with a centralized service. And that's not important for something big like a JP Morgan, a highly regulated financial institution. It makes it a lot easier for an upstart to come in and to create a new service where someone can audit the code and say, hey, this does exactly what it does. Obviously, we can't expect individuals of all sorts to be auditing code. You know, most people don't know how to read code. But there's a very strong industry growing of smart contract auditors, and there's a lot of knowledgeable people that are growing in this space and doing a better job of understanding, you know, what are the best practices here? What outcomes do we want from these smart contracts?
Are smart contract auditors just lawyers?
No, they're software engineers.
Okay, because again, right, my history is a very analog version of this, mm-hmm. which is I write you a contract, I send it to you. You shouldn't sign it unless your lawyer reads it.
Right.
Should I sign a smart contract unless my smart contract auditor reads it?
So either your smart contract auditor or a firm that you trust. Actually, I have a really great example for you of a smart contract that you might find interesting. So a very common thing in the tech world for a tech employee is vesting, right? You join a company, you get stock options, and you know there's a one-year cliff as an example. It's a four-year vesting schedule. What you can do is essentially put that vesting into a smart contract. And what's really interesting about that is you can actually see the funds. They are sitting in that contract. You can pull them at any time. So it's not that you're getting your equity, you know, a month at a time, but rather you're able to pull that at any time. Every block, it's almost a continuous stream of pulling out this equity from the contract. And it's significantly lighter weight. You know, I've read some of these vesting contracts and they're, you know, 200-300 lines of code, which is, at the end of the day, pretty light. And especially if you're reusing the same one over and over again, and you can verify, oh, this is the same vesting contract that Google has used for 100,000 people, then I know that this is something secure that I can probably trust, as opposed to with a lot of legal documents, there's a lot of repetitiveness. Right. When I'm reading, for example, my lease for my apartment in New York, I have the New York Fire Safety Code in there. And there's a lot of other things where it's unclear of what do I actually need to read here? Where in software, there's this idea of modularity, where I can just say, all right, well, I know that there's this Fire Safety Code module in here and I can move on.
I think a lot of lawyers would say the same things about how they read contracts. There's a lot of crossover between the ways lawyers work and the way software engineers work. There's a great Larry Lessig essay from ages ago called Code is Law, which is about that relationship.
The thing I want to push back on, though, is that with software, you can choose your own interface. With a legal document, you don't have that optionality.
I think my question fundamentally, though, is a lot of this makes sense for financial instruments. A lot of this makes sense for payment rails. Here, you are trying to do something far more subjective, which is decide which museum gets the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still unclear why that needs to operate on a decentralized computer network, as opposed to here's a bunch of people you trust, and they've issued you some shares in their organization that provides you governance over those people.
I see. So part of this was just the speed at which we were moving. We wouldn't have been able to do this via traditional mechanisms. In terms of payment processing, you know, we had some very, very large payments come in. We had a donation of $4.5 million that came in overnight one night. Most payment processors are not going to handle that in the span of 15 seconds in the way that a blockchain will. So that was a big part of it. it's also significantly more difficult to get those voting rights into place using these traditional systems. It's not something that's very common outside of the financial world. And this is not, you know, a financial instrument. This is donation and control over a document. So that's why this technology was necessary, because it gave you the ability to have that governance rights without the heavy-handedness of going through a lot of different really important processes, and also guaranteed that the holders that were voting were who they said they were.
That makes sense, although the fact that the second half of the puzzle wasn't assembled yet, where the tokens hadn't actually conferred any articulated rights or voting structure, I'm curious, like, we'll get to it, but I'm curious why people were buying into a thing that they didn't know what they were quite getting yet. We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of voting structure and all that, but we need to start at the beginning. And before we do that, we're going to take a quick break.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. Here's the story of innovation told in 5 words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Support for this podcast comes from Hims. It can be challenging for men to speak about their health, and whether that's a fear of being vulnerable or just wanting to keep things private, there are just some things we would just rather keep to ourselves. Hims knows how you feel, which is why they're looking to provide you the help you need discreetly. Hims is a men's healthcare brand looking to provide simple and convenient access to science-backed treatments for men. The entire process is 100% online, so you can get a new routine of improving your overall health in private. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free and in discreet packaging. No waiting rooms and no pharmacy visits. So while it can be tough to deal with this part of your life, it doesn't mean you have to do it alone. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/decoder. That's hims.com/decoder for your personalized treatment options. hims.com/decoder. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See hims.com/decoder for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
We're back. Before we go too far down the road of talking about donations and voting structure inside the DAO, I wanted to talk to Jonah about how Constitution DAO even got started. Let's start from the beginning. There are 30 core contributing members to Constitution DAO. How did this all start?
Yeah, it started like all great things start on the internet as a meme. There was an article about the Sotheby's auction for the US Constitution, and some crypto people were making jokes of, oh, what if a bunch of crypto people got together and bought the Constitution? Those jokes turned into being a little bit more serious. And there was then a Zoom call where half the people came in joking and the other half came in dead serious. And by the end of the Zoom call, it was kind of decided, all right, we're actually going to go after this thing. And there's precedent for crypto groups bidding on auctions before. PleaserDAO, as one of the examples, they did a $4 million buy of a Wu-Tang Clan album. So we thought, all right, this is a significantly bigger number. At the time, we thought 20 million, but it's in the realm of possibility. So that's when we started planning and organizing. We got a Discord together, a website together. We started talking to museums. We started talking to vendors. And literally 7 days later, we had a representative at Sotheby's bidding with a almost $50 million war chest.
What was your role in this organization?
A lot of this was super vague and we were moving very fast. What I kind of ended up specializing in was newbie onboarding. So how do we teach people that are new to crypto how to get involved with this, how to do it safely, providing support. We also had open Discord rooms where we were helping people troubleshoot. I also contributed a bit to marketing and some things strategically. What we found, and especially because we were moving so fast, is people were very flexible and they were moving all over the place, kind of where they were needed.
It's funny, newbie onboarding, it's why you're on the show now. That's me.
Right.
So I appreciate the expertise there. Tell me, when you're talking to vendors, you obviously need banking partners. You have this partner called Endowments, which another great name. It's DAO in the middle instead of DOW. That's perfect. That's a lot of people trying to do a lot of things all at once. How did it actually come together? Did you not know that it was going to come together?
Yeah, we really didn't know until the end. You know, there was a lot of things happening up in the air, a lot of uncertainty. What we really saw also is as we raised more money, our legitimacy became greater and greater with different institutions.
That's very much an American story.
Very much an American story.
The story of the United States of America is as you have more money, your legitimacy goes up.
Right. And I think, I think a lot of people got really curious. One of the most rewarding parts of this experience was the number of museums that we're speaking to that now want to learn more. You know, they saw us raise $40 to $50 million, depending on the Ether price. And they said, you know, we take 6 months to raise this amount of money. Like, let's talk. How do you do this? And obviously, you know, there were some very specific dynamics that were happening here, but they are very curious now about DAOs, about collective ownership, and all the different things that we explored with this organization.
Were you more interested in the copy of the Constitution or the technology and the organizational speedrun?
I was interested in both of it, you know, and I think what really interested me was the story. And I think there were so many people that were interested in this for different reasons. And I'd encourage you to actually look at our fundraising site. We used a platform called Juicebox, and people could leave messages of, you know, why they were contributing. And there were some really beautiful, heartfelt things. There were people that were talking about how they were descendants of slaves, and they were really excited to now own this document, despite some of the horrible things that were in it. There were immigrants, there were parents that were excited to share this with their children one day. So I think the story and the different emotional things that it evoked in people was really the thing that pulled me in. There's just a very strong emotional pull here. And I'm also very curious about the technology, but that's the secondary factor.
Well, that's interesting. I want to push on that because in the swirl of activity in the 7 days leading up to the auction and then the auction itself, and in the very rapid aftermath, what we heard about almost exclusively was the technology, right? We heard that that this project had proven X, Y, and Z about crypto going mainstream, about DAOs. And what I found very challenging was I heard very little about the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only 13 copies of this thing floating around. And it seemed like the object was a meme. It started as a meme.
Mm-hmm.
And like all internet jokes, there was an element of it which was just a troll. And I'm wondering, did you think that was going to flip when you actually had to govern the Constitution, this copy of the Constitution?
Yeah, so I want to push back on that it was just a troll. I think there was legitimate excitement and curiosity around owning this document. I think a big part of the narrative was around the technology because it's such a new thing, and it's something that's very misunderstood, and people are still trying to wrap their heads around it. So that's why I think the narrative was really driven by the technology, but all great technology exists for one reason, and it's to enable people. And so that's kind of why I was saying the people and the story is what drove me. But you're right, the technology was really important because it drove the narrative, because it said, hey, these crazy crypto people are going to buy a copy of the US Constitution, and what's a DAO, and why are they raising on-chain? What does on-chain mean? So I think those two things combined are kind of the really important thing that drove that narrative. So the technology, yes, was a big part of it, but again, at the end of the day, it just enables humans to do better things.
So this is the part, the flip side. People are spending money. I watched your video, your education video on how to contribute. You recommended that people add $100 or $200 to what they were willing to pay just to pay for the gas fees, which are the transaction fees on the Ethereum network. So you're talking about real money for quite a lot of people in this country, and quite a lot of them contributed. But the back half of it really wasn't plotted out. So what do you think the steps there were? You've raised the money, you win the auction at Sotheby's. What was supposed to happen next?
Yeah. So kind of as I went over earlier, we had this idea of doing a 501c3. None of it was hammered into stone, but the concrete plan was Endowment was going to custody the documents until we had a legal structure together. And that
here's my real question. Like, your organization spends the money, mm-hmm. and you are just going to give it to another organization. That is a very complicated contractual relationship, right?
Yeah.
Were you going to write a contract with endowments to say, we're giving you custody of this document? Were there lawyers on either side of that relationship?
This is, as we've kind of gone over, a very highly experimental technology. This is something that we've done in a very lightweight fashion. And because it's so new, this is something we've done in a very trustful way. Endowment is very well known within the crypto community, and I'm sure they wouldn't want to risk their reputation on doing something negative. So that's kind of the structure that drove this. In the future, I would love to see better legal structures that enable this sort of thing. And I think one of the biggest lessons of Constitution DAO is the technology is so close, but we're not fully ready yet. And there's a lot of rough edges that need to be sanded for this to have gone so much easier in 2 to 5 to 10 years from now.
Sure. But is this a technology question? That's what I keep coming back to. I kind of understand it with payment rails and financialization, which right now are basically operate on computers owned by banks. Okay, let's decentralize those computers. I can get from here to there.
Yeah.
You have a 1 of 13 copy of the founding document of the country.
Yeah.
And you haven't planned out what to do next. Technology doesn't help you solve that problem.
Right.
Right? Someone has to take it and store it and not ruin it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make sure that happens the minute you take possession of the document.
Mm-hmm.
Who is going to do that?
Yeah. So it's both a technology question and a regulatory question. We had some partners that were ready to actually take physical custody of the documents. Sotheby's was willing to hold it for an additional 30 days. One of the reasons we didn't bid our full amount is because we knew we needed money for things along the lines of custodying this document. We needed money for things along the lines of paying fees, taxes. So it's both a question of regulatory and technology and trying to figure out those structures. There are so many great organizations right now working with regulators to make this a lot easier. And I'd say that's one of the things that makes crypto different than a lot of the rest of the tech industry. There are organizations like Coin Center, the Blockchain Association, that are working very hard to get regulators to understand. You know, a lot of this isn't, hey, we want to convince you to let everything run buck wild and free, but hey, let's think very thoughtfully about what a really good policy framework looks like to keep the United States competitive while also keeping investors safe.
Wait, how do we get to regulators from what were you going to do with the Constitution?
So what I was saying is it's a problem of both technology and regulation and trying to tie those two things together so we can figure out how an on-chain entity can hold on to a physical document from a very concrete...
What part of that is regulated?
There is not a clear vehicle for a DAO to interact with a real-world entity.
So you've raised a bunch of money in this DAO. Did you start an LLC? It costs like $50.
Yeah, so we had an LLC essentially as a backup if the relationship with the endowment didn't work out.
Okay, so the DAO had the money, and it held the money on the Ethereum blockchain, in Ethereum. You were going to transfer the money to endowment. You were just going to give it to them.
We had the money in an FTX account that Sotheby's used to verify proof of funds, and endowment was bidding on our behalf.
I'll give you that one. Sotheby's verified
money. I appreciate that.
I'll give you that. That's a big deal, right? I don't think they've done that before. But I'm just curious, the actual steps. You had the money, you made the bid. If you'd won the bid, what happened to the money next?
Yeah. So any money that was left over likely would have been moved back.
If you had won, who would get the money?
Well, it would go either from FTX directly to Sotheby's or to Sotheby's via endowment. I was not directly involved with that process. As I said, I was more involved on the newbie onboarding and the marketing side. So I don't have a actual concrete answer there, unfortunately.
But this to me, the reason I'm asking so explicitly is if I was going to give you money, this would be the question I would want the answer to.
Totally.
Who in the end will get the Constitution? And it seems like that part wasn't actually baked.
Yeah.
Right.
You're right.
This, the third party that I just have to trust that there's no software contract or standard legal contract that I can look at that says we're going to transfer $47 million to Sotheby's. And then somehow this middle organization that I don't know what their governance relationship to Constitution DAO is going to get the Constitution, and then something else will happen. And that, to me, is like, that's all just lawyer stuff, right? Converting LLC or whatever to a 501c3, handing the document back. Like, that's just lawyers. Did you have a budget for lawyers?
Yep, that was part of our budget. And you're right. You know, there was a lot of trust baked in here, but we were very transparent from the beginning that this is a very trustful process. This is not something that at the point where we started was fully decentralized. You know, there was a core team, and we were working as fast as we could towards progressive decentralization. So, you know, you are right that there were those trust assumptions there, and we were very transparent with those from the start. And people felt they could trust us, and they came along for the journey. And we're really grateful for that.
You said when you started about half the people thought it was a joke and half the people were dead serious. I think some people were like, we should just burn it symbolically. Like, what were the internal politics of this core group as this week went on?
There were plenty of internal politics. The thing I think was most interesting was the pace at which we moved and how that really bred trust and how it made it so people really had to choose, if I'm doing this thing, you know, who has control here? Who has the decision-making power? And a lot of that was very often unclear. You know, one thing that would very frequently happen is we would have a vote in our Discord and you'd have maybe an hour in the core team to get your voice in. And some of these were very big decisions. So a lot of it was being in a very high trust environment. There are a lot of people that people didn't know, but pretty much everyone had at least one person they had known previously. So it was this very loose network of people that were vaguely aware of each other that came together. The internal politics were mostly disagreements on direction. There was nothing actually kind of, you know, truly political in the way that you get in a company, because everyone was so mission driven and knew we just need to like get things done really fast.
I just keep coming back to the point of blockchain technology is to decentralize trust, to build trustless systems. And a lot of our conversation has come back to how this was a high trust environment between people. So I'm just trying to explore that tension.
Yeah. So I think this goes back to the fact that the speedrun DAO infrastructure or the DAO infrastructure is still very early. We did use some great trustless technology such as Juicebox, which let us do the fundraise. And people were able to, you know, look at the Juicebox contracts, see how they worked. So that part was really important to us, was that that was done in a contract. It wasn't just a multi-sig for the fundraising. There are a couple other features that were really important there, but this goes back to the fact that we're still early, you know, and this technology is still so new. And we're really, you know, people like to compare it to the early era of the internet, the 1990s. And I think that's pretty accurate.
How do you think software would actually change the politics of an organization? Right. You have some people, you need to make decisions, right? You're voting in Discord. That changes the valence of and speed of decision making, I'm sure. But at the end of the day, like a DAO, let's say it is direct democracy, one token per vote, just the simplest thing to think about. You're still going to get blocks of token holders politicking other blocks of token holders. You're still going to get succession style investor meetings where you vote for leadership, right? Like how does the software actually change any of that outcome? Or are you saying we're just speed running to that outcome?
I think actually for looking at the software, it's actually better to look at more established DAOs because there's some really interesting, innovative things that people are working on. An example I can give is there's a DAO called Index Co-op. Index Co-op makes index funds, right? So you can buy, for example, the DeFi Pulse Index, which has 20 different DeFi tokens. This organization is fully a DAO. The votes on which products do we release, who manages the products, funds for marketing, all that sort of thing is managed on chain. But what they're finding is more complicated organizational structures are needed to be able to keep pace. So there was a really interesting discussion in their forums recently that led to an organizational change where they essentially have what they call wise owls, which are council members that are basically dedicated to stepping in when there's a lack of clarity and either figuring out a way to solve the problem or bringing it to the person that can solve that problem. And I think the thing that makes this really clear and what's really interesting with this software is you can essentially define what are the hard capabilities of someone in an organization, right? Can they call a certain function on a smart contract? Do they have control over a certain amount of funds in the treasury? And I think some of these more cutting edge, more developed DAOs are much more interesting case studies for looking at this, because they've been actively working on this, you know, for in the example of Index Coop, over a year with people working full time on that project.
Yeah. I find the whole thing fascinating. But at the end of the day, you're the one who raised all the money and got all the attention, right? Like that's the,
yep.
That's to me is the gap where I'm looking at the stats. 5% of your donors was their very first transaction with a wallet. Mm-hmm. Almost half of your donors, 48%, under 40 transactions with a wallet. You brought a lot of people into the fold.
Mm-hmm.
And that next step seems like, is your speed running an organization? That's a lot of people trusting you with their money.
It is.
What happens now?
So you're right. It's a lot of people trusting us with their money. That's why there were two things that were really important here. One was transparency. You know, we were upfront with everything that was going on throughout the process. And two was refunds. It's a big reason that we chose the smart contract that we did for the fundraise, because it had that built-in refund functionality. And, you know, we did exactly what we said we were going to do. We were going to raise money. We were going to bid at the auction. And had we lost, which we did, we were going to offer refunds. And the refunds are available for people to claim.
We need to take a quick break, but I'm not going to forget to talk about refunds. We will get to it after the break.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
We're back with Jonah Ehrlich. We were just talking about refunds, but I want to talk about the auction first. Then we'll come back to the refunds. You raised $47 million, but your maximum bid for the auction was $43 million. That number, if I understand it correctly, Sotheby's had to verify your max bid. And they told you to hold some in reserve for taxes and fees and storage and all of that. So that's how I got to $43 million. When did you know that $43 million was the maximum?
It was very, very shortly before. So we did our proof of funds about 3 hours before the auction. We were hoping to be able to continue fundraising throughout those last few hours, but totally understand that, you know, we had to go through the process of making sure that they could verify we had the money they have. You know, this was something very new for Sotheby's, and we're really grateful that they chose to partner with us and work with us to verify these funds.
So you didn't win. And a famous billionaire investor named Ken Griffin, run Citadel, won the auction. He came in at $43.2 million, which is not that much more. I imagine that's quite frustrating.
You know, I think it's frustrating, but that's the way the world is. And if we can't win based on our own merits, then I think we just need to work harder to build a stronger ecosystem. I see this as a moment of inspiration. I want to wish Ken also a congratulations. I know he has some really great plans to display the document and make it so people are able to see it and engage with it. And I hope that after this, Ken also takes the opportunity to engage a little bit more deeply with what we're doing.
Well, Ken, if you're listening, and I'm sure he is, reach out to Jonah. What was it like for you watching the auction?
So a group of us actually ended up getting together in New York to watch the auction together. It was, you know, exhilarating. Internally, we knew who was the person that was bidding on our behalf, but obviously we were not able to release that until after the result of the auction. I felt internally during it, when the number was creeping up, like I was going to puke. And then I think if we won, I might have cried. So it was a very intense experience, especially after this crazy week. And one of the coolest parts is I got to meet a ton of people in person that I knew from the internet. Friends of the internet IRL, which was such a fun experience. And even though we lost, you know, people were sad for a little bit, but there was so much hope about what we accomplished. You know, we got DAOs on some of the largest news publications in the world and teaching people about this technology. We got all of these new people to actually try this. And I think that's a big part of new technology and of crypto specifically, is people often understand it better when they actually try it out. One thing I like to think about, you know, as a student of the history of technology, is that the way that people adopt things is because they have to. So if you think about email, for example, right? A lot of people were in the 90s, why would I use email? This is ridiculous. And then you fast forward and it's, oh, I'm going to get fired if I don't use email because I'm not capable of doing my job. By no means is Constitution DAO something along the lines of, this is something I absolutely need to do. But it's a start that piques people's curiosity, and it gets more people asking, what could I do with this thing?
Do you think you introduced more people to crypto and DAOs or more people to the Constitution?
Definitely more people to crypto and DAOs. I think a lot of people knew what the Constitution was, and I think their interest was piqued because they were familiar with the Constitution. I think people also really liked the Nick Cage memes. I think people had a lot of fun with those.
They were very good.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a lot of confusion at the end of the auction. So you knew who was bidding, but we just knew people were bidding. We knew their names. We had no idea who they represented. Mm-hmm. And then immediately there was a Twitter space, and it was late at night, and I don't remember who was in the Twitter space, but the Twitter space was full of, we won. Where did that disconnect come from?
So we don't know exactly how that happened. Everyone on the core team was told not to post on social media, not to engage until the official results were out. The people associated with that space were not affiliated with our team. So this is some classic social media confusion that was happening there. And it was really unfortunate. I saw some of the memes when we won, and some of them were very funny and joyous. Or sorry, not when we won, but when people thought we had won. Yeah, so, you know, there was so much joy, and it really felt like a bummer to get that official statement out. And I think there's a lot to still be optimistic and excited about. Yeah, it was just, it was, unfortunately, you know, people are going to do what they do on social media that are not affiliated with the team.
When did you find out? Was it right away? You knew who was bidding, so that's when you knew.
Yeah, we knew right away.
What was the plan to release that information?
Yeah, so we were waiting for final confirmation from Sotheby's, and then we had an official statement that we released on social media.
And then you've refunded about 55% of the money. There was some initial confusion about refunds, right? The whole thing was going to get wound down, and refunds were going to happen in some way, but then there was some outcry, and you've changed it. How are refunds working now?
Yeah. Just to clarify here, we actually didn't change it. We were exploring another avenue that we decided not to approach, and we went back to the original plan just because we felt like that was the simplest and that was the safest.
Well, so tell me the difference between the two.
Yeah. So there are a few options that we explored. We actually hadn't fully settled on one, but the plan that we had was essentially we redeposited the funds back into the contract on Juicebox, and then people were able to do a withdrawal of their refund.
And that's what's happening now.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
What was the other plan that you explored that you decided against?
There are a few different options, not really worth getting into the details there, but we essentially decided that all of them had sufficient technical risk. And with technical risk comes the risk that we lose people's money. And that was unacceptable.
One of the challenges now is people have paid $100 in gas fees to donate $100. They might pay $100 in gas fees to get their $100 back. There are some people who've already paid more to get their money back than they put in. Isn't this one of the core challenges of this entire project, that the transaction fees actually outweigh everything else that's happening?
Yeah. So this is a really important criticism. This is something we were transparent with from the start. And we were telling people, hey, the gas fee is part of it. There is this transaction fee. And if there's refunds, there's also going to be a transaction fee. And people were aware of that. it's part of any new technology. And what it really reminds me of is actually a story that's kind of very near to my heart about Satoru Iwata, who worked at Nintendo. And Iwata was developing the Pokemon Gold and Silver games. And what was very interesting about Pokemon Gold and Silver is they had two different regions, right? There were two different broad areas to explore. Now, the cartridges they used at that time were very constrained in terms of storage. And in the software world, there's a legendary story of Iwata basically figuring out a way to do compression that fit both of these regions into that card. And that's the era we're in right now with crypto, is we still haven't gotten all of the scalability and all of the bandwidth figured out yet. So right now, we're still in those early days of trying to pack in as much as we can at the lowest fee cost. And that's part of technology, you know. A lot of things start off as a slightly worse experience than the technology of the day, but as they improve over time, they become significantly better. Another example of this, I bet we'll also see in the upcoming years, is self-driving cars. You know, worse than a human now. Eventually, I hope to never drive a car again.
I'm with you. And we talked to a lot of self-driving car CEOs in the show. I think they're right there with you. But you're in the here and now, right? Like, the technology will get better does not solve the problem of someone who was in love with the idea of buying the Constitution and gave you $50 and is out $200 in fees around that $50. How do you solve the problem for that person?
Yeah, so that's why there was transparency from the start. And it's unfortunate. You know, I wish there could have been lower fees. There are scaling solutions, but they didn't have the contract with that refund feature, which was really important to us. So we felt like just from the start, we needed to be super transparent, especially when we were just targeting people that are what we call crypto native. They understand that fees are part of it. And for those that weren't crypto native, that's why we wanted to make very clear in our education, hey, there will be fees. This is part of using the network.
So you refunded about 55% of the money, right? We've got all the great stats about the people who contributed for the first time or among their first time. In terms of refunds, do you have stats on, were the same first-time wallets requesting the refunds? Is the 45% of funds left over, is that from your first-time donors? Because that, to me, would be very telling.
Yeah, I wish I had those stats for you. So actually, the dashboard that we had for who contributed and how was a community-built dashboard. And that's one of the really cool things about this technology is someone who is totally unaffiliated was actually just able to pull the blockchain data and make this dashboard on what's going on. I'm sure it wasn't as exciting for them to do the refund dashboard, so they did a little bit but didn't put details on who and how much per wallet and that sort of thing. There was an overall refund dashboard. So yeah, we don't have that data, unfortunately. But I do think the fact that, you know, it wasn't even someone on our team, it wasn't someone affiliated, it was just a third party that wanted access to this data. And because it was publicly on the blockchain, they could share it with us and share it with the world.
But doesn't this sort of implicate everything we've been talking about, right? Like, this is all about trust. It's about transparency, accountability. Mm-hmm. In the mad scramble of things to do, building dashboards is always the lowest level of priority. I understand that.
Yeah.
But at some point, knowing who your donors are and taking care of the newest ones should have risen up that priority chain, right? Is that on your mind? We should go figure out who the people we introduce to crypto are and make sure that they feel taken care of, because that is the big victory of this project right now.
Yeah, so that's why we've still been active in the Discord, providing support to people that are trying to figure out how to do this. So the dashboard would be great, I agree, but I'd rather engage with people directly that are asking me, you know, both individually in direct messages, but also in the general Discord. Hey, I'm struggling to do this, or, oh, I'm not sure if the funds transferred out, can you check? I think that's the really important part is it's nice to have a dashboard that we can share with other people, but I would much rather work with those individuals and actually get them those refunds.
So 45% of the money is sitting there. That number has tailed off. At least I looked at the dashboard right before we started recording. It seems like you hit 55% refunds and it has just stayed there for several days. Why do you think that is?
I think part of it is the gas fees, as we were kind of talking about. I think part of it is people not paying attention as much. You know, there's a lot of people in the crypto world that move very fast and they miss things. this is mostly people that are crypto natives and they've got, you know, 30, 40, 50 different things that they're paying attention to at once. So I expect over time that number will continue tapering off. But there's a lot of people in crypto that are kind of just throwing bets everywhere and seeing what happens.
Do you think you have $20 million of let's see what happens money in the bank right now? Or on the chain? The bank is the wrong
place. Well, to clarify, I think the gas fees are a big part of it.
Okay.
And I think it's not a let's see what happened, but rather a, you know, not paying attention or haven't made the time to do it yet. It's very exciting and you want to jump right in when it's like, hey, you know, I want to donate to buy a copy of the Constitution, but it's, oh, I want to claim my refund. It's not as fun, you know? Yeah. So I think people are in less of a rush.
A classic business model is make people claim their refunds. I don't think that's what you're doing, but
No, because we don't have access to those funds either.
Yeah. What are you going to do if 5 years from now, there's still, I mean, it could be more. You've got however many, mm-hmm. right, on the wallet right now, the price of Ethereum moves quite a bit. 5 years from now, if that 45% of your money is still there, it could be worth $50 million again. What's the plan?
The refunds will be available indefinitely. The smart contract is on the chain and it can't be modified. So someone could come back, you know, 20 years from now and say, oh, I realized I still had funds here. I want to pull them out. And I expect a lot of the tooling to get better here. One thing that's really popular nowadays is you have those apps that tell you how many subscriptions you're subscribing to that you don't know about. We're going to start to see that with a lot of blockchain-based things because people are going to realize they have money in nooks and crannies all over the place that wasn't worth a lot when they first put it in there. And then way down the line, it's, oh, I should really go grab this.
There's a secondary market for the people token that's already developed. That seems very strange because it's not related to an ongoing organization. What do you make of that?
When we were choosing which platform we were going to use, there was a series of trade-offs we had to make. And the thing that we really wanted to optimize for the most was the refunds. And part of that was choosing Juicebox, which Juicebox has the tokens and you can claim the token even if we don't win the auction. That was not something that we had advised people to do. We were telling people just to claim their refunds. So with the blockchain, you know, you can't really stop people. So it is nothing that's affiliated with the team anymore and we're sunsetting the project. It's something that exists out there, but not something we've been endorsing.
Do you have a sense of why people are building a secondary market for this token?
People like the memes.
You think that's it?
People like the memes. They like to have fun. One thing that I've learned from kind of exploring the crypto world is that it's very hard to rationalize a lot of the different momentum things that happen with memes and with kind of the memetic transfer of information. So, you know, I think if people are having fun and they're doing their thing, then I don't try and interpret it too deeply because I'm just going to break my brain.
Well, I this is where I kind of want to end it, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of really big ideas here. I think it is fundamentally cool that people try to raise a lot of money to buy a copy of the Constitution. It's just fundamentally cool. At the end of the day, though, the internet has always been good at just like firing a bazooka of money at things from almost the first day. Like you can go back to the ice bucket challenge when people fired a bazooka of money at the ALS Association. They were not necessarily ready for it. You hoped they would do good things with it and that they actually invested in research. And in this case, thankfully they did. But the internet has always found a cause and fired a bazooka of money at things. There's a part of this where the layer on top of it is financializing the bazooka of money in extremely surprising ways, in ways that move with momentum that breaks my brain too, it breaks your brain. Do you think that's good? Like, I find that financialization of everything, like, I look at it, I'm like, now there's a secondary market of a token that was meant to govern the physical copy of a constitution, but now we're just, like, playing in the wreckage of this project. Like, there's something about that that seems not great. Like, it actually cuts against your goals, and I'm wondering if you think about that tension.
It's a really good philosophical question and also a very, you know, concrete question. I think for this, a big part of, you know, my belief with technology is people will do what they can. and people are going to be curious and they're going to try things. And I think it's our job as a society to figure out what things do we want to come from that and what things do we not want to come from that. So I do think it is interesting to be pushing the boundaries. I'm not talking about this case specifically, but with, you know, how can we repackage and organize information and value and governance and all that sort of, all those mechanisms. But I think it's going to take some time to figure out what the right thing is. That's one thing I've actually really appreciated about the way that kind of the US government compared to some other governments is approaching crypto regulation, is they are giving the industry some space to breathe. And they're saying, all right, let's kind of watch what's happening in the depths here and try and understand with this more limited group of people that know they're getting into a very highly risky asset class, you know, what are we going to learn from this smaller group? And I do want to emphasize again that, you know, what we were doing was a donation for governance. It's something to vote on the future of this document. And the intention that we had was, how can we make this document something that's governed by the people?
You introduced a lot of people to these concepts for the first time. And now some of them have taken their refunds. Some of them are waiting on gas fees. Some of them are just happy to have participated. What do you think the takeaway for that group of people should be? Oh, I can spend money on cool things and it's kind of a meme and there's a community, or here are some new instruments of fundamentally corporate governance.
I think it's the latter. I think the takeaway is, you know, what things do you want to happen in the world and how do you make that happen? And is this the right tool set? And there's been a proliferation already of really interesting DAOs that are doing lots of exciting projects. A few examples are, there's a DAO that's now working on prison reform. There's another that's working on how do we create more public scientific research. There's one that's working on acquiring actually another document, one that acquired an anti-slavery document from U.S. history. So I think we're already starting to see the effects of this. And I think in the long term, we're going to see more DAOs for people that are trying to do things that don't fit in the structure of a company and a nonprofit, but more of a community collective. And we're going to see lots of people take the lessons from what we did and build better tooling and better best practices.
So let's end where you started, which was the interface between the crypto world and the DAO community world and the real world is not yet built out. I understand why it's happening in financial institutions first. That's all just computer stuff. Literally, we just had an Excel influencer on the show. Like, most of that industry is people using Excel or computers to do stuff, and you can automate that and reconstitute those contracts on decentralized databases right away. When you're talking about prison reform, that is bodies in the world doing things. Fundamentally, that is not computer work. Where do you think the next steps between, okay, we want DAOs to come together to form governance collectives and impact in the real world is? What's the next most important step?
So when you look at a DAO today, there's a few things that a DAO can actually do. And I think the thing we need to bridge the gap with is, what can a smart contract actually control? Because that's the source of a DAO's power. For a lot of DAOs today, the majority of what they do is just sending treasury funds, right? We want to send $20 million to start a crypto lobbying group. This is a real world example from Uniswap, which is a decentralized exchange that had a vote to start this crypto lobbying group. However, I think over time, we can build out more functionality for the powers of DAOs, both from the voting power, what the actual token holders can vote on, but also, let's say, elected representatives that the DAO gives very specific, concrete, and audible powers to.
I feel like I could go another hour on this. I really want to know if the lobbyist DAO gets to pick what steak restaurant they take elected officials to. Like, can you vote on that? That'd be really interesting. But you've given us so much time. What's next for you? What's next for the core members of the Constitution DAO group?
So Constitution DAO, we're finishing shutting down official activities. Refunds are going. Everyone's, you know, dispersing to different projects. You know, I have a day job as a software engineer at a very different, but I would say just as exciting part of the tech industry. So people are, you know, working on what they've been working on, but I expect we'll see more from this group in the future. it was really incredible. I'd say one of the best parts of this experience is I made some new friends. And that's really fun, where people you know from the internet, you can now pick up the phone and say, hey, do you want to go hang out? Want to go grab a coffee?
Yeah, that's great. Well, Jonah, thank you so much for coming on Decoder. Thank you. I pushed you a little bit. Thank you for engaging. I really appreciate it.
Neil, I thank you for having me. This has been a great experience and glad to be on this journey of understanding crypto with you.
Thank you again to Jonah Ehrlich for taking the time to talk today. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, I'd love to hear what you think of Decoder. You can email us at decoder@theverge.com. You can tweet at me directly. I'm @reckless on Twitter. If you like Decoder, please share it with your friends and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you really like the show, give us that 5-star review. Decoder is a production of The Verge and part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Creighton DeSimone and Jackie McDermott. We are edited by Callie Wright. Our music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We'll see you next time.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure, it's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.